One, two, three. This is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University, and we're back. I'm an author, psychologist, and speaker. And every week we talk about how to love ourselves, others, and higher nature, how to improve our love, relationships, our finances, career, health, and spirituality. And this week we're at the Miami Book Festival in the city of Miami, Florida, having a wonderful time looking at all the guests that are here, the readers, the fans. And we have a very interesting guest today, whose name is Michelle Jessica, also known as MJ Fievre. She is a woman that comes from Haiti, or as a Haiti. As a teenager, she began her publishing career. She did her first mystery novel at the age of 16. She signed her first book contract at the age of 19. Her short stories and poems in English have appeared in various anthologies and magazines. Her plays have been performed in the Miami Micro Theater. She's a longtime educator, frequent keynote speaker. She holds an MFA, is an editor, and founded the Silver of Stone magazine. And she often returns to Haiti to conduct writing workshops for helping young students become writers. In 2015, she received the Beacon of Hope, an achievement award from the Council General of Haiti. Welcome, Jessica MJ Fievre, to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have you. And now your name, I think, Fievre, means fever.
Yes, it does.
And they say that you put readers in a fever pitch with some of your mystery horror novels. So how does that work? When you write these novels, are you trying to entice people to feel something? Is it a fear? Is it excitement?
Well, when I was growing up in Haiti, I was really interested in horror because I felt that there was so much going on in the streets of Haiti that I wanted another kind of horror that was artificial as opposed to surreal. So I became interested in reading books about horror, and before I knew it, I was writing my own horror books.
Okay. Well, the idea of horror, I mean, a lot of people like horror, you know, like Stephen King, and, you know, it's exciting. But the whole idea of people liking that, why do you think that people love scary things so much?
I think it might be partly because of the physical reaction that you get from horror stories. Adrenaline is making you all excited. I think it has a lot to do with
that.
They
even did a study with male females that said there's more romance when you see a scary movie because you interpret that as some kind of arousal or excitement. So people get more romantic.
Right.
Is that true?
I can see that, definitely.
Yes. But on the other side of that, you know, if you look at horror, I mean, it can also be fear. Now, I know you talk about fear a little bit. And there's a psychologist named David Hawkins who looks at levels of consciousness. Like for example, he gives a number to them. Like maybe 100 is fear. 1,000 would be self-actualization, like love and, you know, the highest level. Mm-hmm. So fear really is kind of a low level of consciousness. So what do you think of that? Because you do mention something about Nelson Mandela. You say, courage is not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about fear. How do you see fear in life, especially coming from Haiti, which you say has a lot of hard things there?
Well, it took me a while to get over my fears. So I was in a situation for a long time where every second of my life was lived in fear, not just because of what was going on in the country on a political level, but I come from a very complicated family as well. So the fear was everywhere, indoors and outdoors. And
so did you have an abusive parent or something difficult?
Let's say that my dad was pretty complex, and yeah, there were definitely some instances of abuse, and it took me a while to get over that. So I guess I learned very early that I needed to be able to deal with that fear if I wanted to move forward.
Now, some countries, in Africa, they have very strict forms of discipline. Like, they actually hit the children, and, you know, even the village does that. What is it like in Haiti? Is that similar? Is it a corporal punishment common there?
Yes, for sure, corporal punishment is commonplace there. But it still comes as a surprise when it happens.
Okay. Do you agree or disagree with corporal punishment? Say, if you had children, how would you raise them?
I don't agree with it at all. I think that it's emotionally damaging for children, and that there are so many other ways. I'm an educator. I taught middle school for so long, and I came to learn that there are so many other ways to correct a bad behavior. I would definitely not recommend corporal punishment.
Okay. Now, the idea of fear, like, some societies do control people with fear. What is it like in Haiti? Because you said you wrote a memoir, A Sky, the Color of Chaos.
Yes.
You talked about your childhood in Haiti. You said that you watched shows like The Seventh Heaven, where everyone's happy, right? Happy families.
Right.
but they didn't have protests, shootings, lootings, and home invasions. So what was it like growing up in a fear environment?
Fear is definitely used in Haiti as a way to control the people there. We've had many dictatorships where people were afraid to talk against the government because the consequences would be dire. So, and I explored that aspect a little bit in my memoir, Sky the Color of Chaos. Mm-hmm. The fact that I even considered writing this book was an act of rebellion, because in Haiti, things are not shared in that way. You don't air out your dirty laundry. Mm-hmm. It's not part of that the culture, because the culture is marked by it's a culture of silence. It's marked by all the dictatorships and the fear that is still prevalent there, actually.
So as a writer, do you still write for Haitian people? Do you still write for them?
When I started my career, my writing was in both French and Creole.
Yes.
And I lived in Haiti back then, so my work was definitely aimed at a Haitian readership. Mm. When I left Haiti at the age of 21, I started writing a little bit more in English. I had studied in Haiti, but well, now that I was in the United States, it became my language of choice for writing. And although I continued writing about Haiti, my experience there, and my readership certainly includes people of Haiti, I think I've become a little bit more mainstream in not just the topics that I approach, but also the way that I approach them. And there's obviously the shift as well from fiction to nonfiction, and then to the kind of work that is dedicated a little bit more to self-actualization.
Now, MJ, you asked me before the show why I started this podcast, and I was saying that I've always loved psychology and desire to extend loving energy. And I was an introvert and shy child. And I think you told me you were also kind of not fitting in. You were the other, I would say.
Right.
Were you introvert or shy, or was there something about you different in Haiti that propelled you to write?
I've always considered myself to be in the margins. When I was in Haiti, I was definitely very shy. Mm-hmm. I was the one who would use recess to catch up on reading. We would stay behind to talk to the teachers
literature. Call you the nerd, right. What do you call it, teacher's pet?
Yes, absolutely. When I became a teenager, I guess that I was slightly cooler than I had been. I started going out more, having more friends, but I was still interested in learning and reading and being I was still a little nerdy. Then when I moved to the U.S., I focused completely on my studies. When I first got to Miami, it took me a little while to go back to reading and writing for fun. I was I wanted to be the perfect student.
Yes.
But then I went back to writing, and with writing always comes a kind of isolation. So I went back to being more into introspection and trying to figure out the world.
I see. Now, I know you do a lot of work with children in Haiti. Are you helping them be writers, or what is it you're trying to do?
I took 2 trips in Haiti, although not recently because the situation there, the political situation, has worsened. I took 2 trips to Haiti, and I went to many schools offering workshops for free.
Yes.
And my philosophy is that writing saved me, and that writing can save other people as well when they're dealing with emotional turmoil, particularly in a country like Haiti, where it's not all in the head, the danger is so real. So I went back, I spent 2 weeks every time. Every day I went to a different school, just teaching kids the basic of storytelling. I think it was a good experience for them to hear it, not only from their teachers, but from someone who has made writing a center piece of their life.
Wow. I guess also reading too, if we encourage reading, that's a great thing. Literacy.
Absolutely.
And also, you give advice to writers. I think you were saying, don't sentimentalize or use cliches. And also, write your truth. And you quote an author, Anne Lamont, that says, You want everything, you own everything that happened to you in the past. So, like, don't be afraid of saying that. So why is that such an important advice?
It's important because, again, coming from a culture of silence where there's a lot of guilt about sharing our experiences, and those experiences, in order for you to be able to really overcome them, particularly when they are so violent and so damaging to the soul.
Yes.
I think it's important for people to be able to come forward and talk about it, and talk about what they've gone through. It's a form of freedom.
Now, MJ, when you wrote your memoir, did you talk about your family?
I did.
And was that an issue? Like, were you embarrassed about it? Did you feel weird, or were you okay with it?
I guess at first it was really difficult because I never imagined that I was even allowed to write about my experience in Haiti, about my parents. And later, that uncertainty did become a little bit, took the form of shame, because my family was really unhappy with the book.
Really?
They were not denying the contents of the book.
Oh.
They were mad that I would talk about private matters.
Wow. But your mom is here, so she forgave you, or no?
I don't know. I guess she did.
I
think she still have mixed feelings about it.
Okay.
But I mean, we have to move on.
Well, I would think they'd be proud of you also, I mean, to write a book as successful.
I mean, she was proud when I was just writing fiction.
Oh, okay.
But when I transitioned from writing novels, young adult novels, to writing a full-blown memoir about what was going on at home, she got really mad. I think that now she's back to being happy with my career, because I switched gears, and my last book, Happy Okay, is all about, it's a poetry book in play format, and it's all about helping people with their depression.
Yeah, I want to get into that. I'm very interested in that book. But the idea that we have to be true to ourselves, authentic, no matter what happens, I think that's something you're talking about. Even though you said people may be a little upset, you know, hurt feelings and all that. But at the same time, you're not doing it to be mean. Huh? You're trying to help people understand, right? I guess what happened in Haiti and also your family. Now, the other thing is, I believe you're a publisher, is that correct?
Yes.
Now, how about authors that get rejected a lot? You know, you have to reject them sometimes, right? Like, I don't like this. How do they deal with that? You know, no one likes rejection. So what's your advice to authors that are afraid of writing because of that?
I always remind authors that I've seen both sides. I've seen the writer's side and the publisher's side. And I never reject a writer without letting them know why their book cannot be accepted. So I think that a lot of writers appreciate that. And I've had writers who submitted a book and then came back later with a better book after they understood what was the issue. Because sometimes it's not even the writing itself. It might be that it's not the right time for the market. It might be that the writer needs to work on their brand before they get published.
Yes.
So I do take the time to talk to writers and let them know, you know, I've been in your shoes. I know what it is to try so hard to put a book out there and get rejected. So I try to be as useful as possible.
Okay. What's the name of your publishing house, and what kind of books do you guys like?
So I work as a publisher, I worked with different companies.
Oh, okay.
So I have my own company, Logan Masterworks, where we work with writers who want to self-publish.
Okay.
But we don't take on any writers. We have to really believe in the book. So that's where it's more than self-publishing. We call it artisan publishing, because not everybody is automatically accepted.
Right.
Okay. Then personally, I'm also involved with different smaller publishers. They are not part of the big five, but they're doing very well for themselves. For instance, I work as an acquisitions editor for Mango Publishing in Coral Gables.
Okay.
We are pretty young. It's our sixth year, I believe, but we've accomplished so much. We were named Publisher of the Year last year by Publishers Digest.
That's pretty good.
I'm
thinking of writing a novel, so I'll send it to you.
And that's the thing too. We at Mango, for instance, we don't do fiction.
Ah, okay.
We do mostly nonfiction.
Oh, okay. That's right. Only nonfiction. Okay.
Yes.
But see, for nonfiction to fiction is a big of a change.
Right.
You,
right.
You did the opposite, right? You went from fiction to nonfiction.
Yes. Yes.
Is one easier than the other or harder?
I think it's. I really feel like it's totally different in terms of the experience I go through when I write one or the other.
Right.
Fiction is more fun and it's all about creation, and nonfiction is. There's a lot of introspection, and sometimes it makes it very difficult, and it's not as enjoyable as fiction.
Right, it takes more research and, you know,
right.
understanding. Now, you also have something you call flash fiction. They said twisted stories between insanity and normalcy. What does that mean? I never heard that one.
So I became acquainted with flash fiction when I took a class with John Dufresne. He's a local writer, bestseller, New York Times bestselling
wow.
author, and it's basically about writing a story with as writing the story and have it be as short as possible.
Oh, okay.
So some of the stories might be a paragraph long. Some of them might be three sentences long. So I became really interested in teaching the form myself. Mm-hmm. And it's a great exercise for even people who are not necessarily interested in only writing flash fiction. It teaches about economy and focusing on what really matters in the story.
So flash is then about is about the length, but is it also about the power? Like, I think a flash is a something like a hurricane or, you know, a thunder. Is there something emotional
right.
about it?
It's definitely very powerful. It's so brief that special attention is paid to the impact that it's going to have
wow.
on the reader. And the structure is also different because instead of having a beginning, a middle, and end, like the traditional story, you start with a moment and you weave the story around that moment.
Wow. Is that a new form of fiction or is that something that's...
It's been around for a while. I mean, the French authors did that a lot in the past. When you
yes.
think, for instance, about Guy de Maupassant, he has a few short pieces that are available out there. And I know this other French writer, his name is escaping me, but he wrote what everybody called prose poems, but they turned out to actually be flash fiction pieces.
By the way, I love that French accent you have. Parlez-vous français?
Je parle français.
Je parle un peu de français.
Ah, très bien.
A little bit. High school-wise, but it's a beautiful accent. I really
thank
like
you.
It.
Thank you.
Now, I'm thinking, I was going to ask you a question, MJ. Are you happy? Okay.
I certainly try to be as much as possible. I've come to realize that happiness is not a constant. It's something that you continually have to work on. And I try to remember that every day that I need to work on being happy every single day.
What makes you happy? Or how can people be happy? What's the secret?
I think it's about coming to terms with the realization that life sometimes just sucks, sorry.
Okay.
And being able to accept that it's not always going to be all rosy, and just be ready to face those moments without forgetting that tomorrow will be better. And I think that's what allows me to stay happy whenever I'm going through something that is tough. I remember the good days, and I just get ready for more of those good days to come along.
So you're kind of optimistic in a sense, but also you're remembering past, like you said, happy memories.
Right, yes.
So you bring your mind constantly to the happy part of things, kind of reorganizing the mind. And they also say that you're a great person too. People have called you that.
thank you.
So how do you feel? You seem like a very humble, maybe a little shy in some ways. How are you great?
I mean, I don't know how to answer this question.
I'm not being egotistical, but let's say that you're great. And what's, I mean, why do people call you that? Because I've read somewhere that they call you great.
I mean, I try to be a good person.
Yes.
I make a conscious effort to cultivate those traits that I think are make the world a better place.
Okay.
I try to be positive. I try to be a good daughter, a good wife, a good friend.
Okay.
And it's not always easy, particularly nowadays when we live in a society that encourages the ego to flourish as
yes.
opposed to other important aspects of the self. So I try. It's not always easy. I mean, we can't be everything to everybody, but yes. I certainly try to be as loving as I can.
I like that answer. So lovingness is a form of greatness, right? When you love others and you love yourself and a higher nature. Now, you did write the book Happy Okay, which is a great book, poetry collection. It says here, shaking out the stigma of mental illness.
Yes.
Deal with depression, anxiety, grief, and loss. And you talk about a woman here that goes through a transition, I think. Mm-hmm. And she says, looks can be deceiving. She's in a beautiful city of people, but she feels depressed and anxious. Paloma.
Yes.
And then she has a flash of clarity and she learns something about happiness. So tell us about Paloma. What did she discover?
So I'm going to go back a little bit and talk about the way the book came to be. So I mostly wrote fiction growing up. And when I got to the United States, although my focus became nonfiction, I continued writing fiction, but this time in the form of plays. Yes. And I produced a few plays for the Miami Micro Theater and the O Miami Poetry Festival. And after a while, I came to realize that although they were fictional pieces, they were all focused, they seemed to focus on the same character. Mm-hmm. And this character was dealing with a lot of emotional issues, with mental illness, depression, and the sensation that she wasn't loved the way she would like to be, and she felt unlovable. And I kind of look at those different plays, and I realized that if I put them all together, I did get the full story of Paloma. So in a way, Paloma is that young woman who actually represents so many people, not just people of her gender, of her age, of her ethnicity. She represents anyone really who's dealing with mental illness, particularly depression and anxiety. Yes. And it was important for me to be able to put out this book because I come from a culture where talking about mental illness is completely taboo, particularly depression. I was telling someone the other day that when you go to the psychologist or the psychiatrist in Haiti, there's one door to enter and one door to exit so that you never see the next
wow.
patient. I don't know if it's still this way, but that's how it used to be when I lived there. So I wanted to be able to talk about what it is to live with depression and also how difficult it is for the people surrounding the person who's dealing with depression.
Yes.
So in the story, we get Paloma interacting with her lover, Jose Armando, who means well, but doesn't necessarily understand mm-hmm. what Paloma is going through.
Right.
And the hope is that by the end of the book, the reader better understands the difficulty of mental illness.
So MJ, you talk about for Paloma and also healing, you say breathing, gratitude and self-care, and keeping the faith. And you have a couple lines here. Now, it says here, you watch me like I'm somebody who needs watching, and I don't feel beautiful when I'm pinned and wriggling under the microscope of your gaze. What does that mean?
Well, I went through a very difficult experience after the earthquake in Haiti. I was involved in helping the soldiers that were on site find survivors. And I didn't sleep for days, and I went too far in terms of not taking care of myself.
Wait a minute, you were finding dead people?
No, I was helping them. So it was a system where, for the first time, we realized in the Caribbean the importance of social media.
Right.
I have a big network, and I was getting a lot of messages about people who were still alive but unable to be rescued.
Oh, okay.
And at the same time, there were soldiers on site helping find those people.
Okay.
And I served as the link to let them know where to go. And for 3 days, I was getting all those messages and trying my best to help. And I did not sleep at all.
Wow.
And at the end of the 3 days, I crashed.
Wow.
And I had to sign myself in the hospital because I had a total breakdown.
Wow.
And I remember when I came home after those 3 days, my family did not really know how to treat me.
Yes.
They were maybe afraid that I was going to hurt myself. And so I felt like I was under a microscope. And that's what I mean when I talk about like I'm somebody who needs watching, And it makes me feel really ugly. It not a physical ugliness, but that I was broken and unworthy of even being here.
Wow.
So it was a weird feeling from feeling so useful, trying to do my part to help with the situation in Haiti while I was in the U.S., but at the same time dealing with the feeling that I was not enough.
Wow. But you also have a positive phrase that says, a man, and also a woman, I assume, cannot light their own fire, who cannot light their own fire, is doomed to reside in only dark and cold places. All around you, the sky is warming the asphalt, the air is alive.
Yes.
So that's like hope, right? So tell us about that one.
Absolutely. So when someone undergoes depression, you see what is out there, other people being happy, other people kind of quote-unquote making it, but you are in a place where it's dark and hope doesn't exist, and you're trying to reach out to that happiness that seems outside of you. And a lot of times we wait for something to happen and make us able to embrace that happiness, when really we have to be the one working actively to gain happiness. We cannot depend on other people, because people leave, people disappoint, unfortunately people die. If you being centered depends on other people, then it's not gonna work, because you can only trust yourself to get your own happiness.
Yeah, very beautifully said. It seems like you have a psychology kind of desire, that you like, you know, this whole idea of spirituality and psychology.
I definitely spent a lot of time thinking about mental illness, because I've been dealing with it for so long.
Okay. You personally have dealt with it?
Yeah, absolutely. I started having symptoms when I was a teenager.
Like depression, anxiety?
Depression, mostly. Okay. And of course, it was attributed to my age, because teenagers are moody. They're in transition. They're becoming adults.
Right.
But when it followed me into adulthood, I started wondering what was wrong. So I did a lot of reading and I did a lot of introspection and talking to people and seeing professionals, trying to figure out what was wrong with me. And I talk from that place. I write from that place as well.
Wow, so you have a personal experience.
Right, yes.
Are you here now, or are you still working on it?
I have to work at it every day.
Yes.
It's not something that you just get over despite treatment and everything else. It's never gonna go away, and I think that's the kind of acceptance I was talking about. The day I realized that's who I am, and it's going to be my job until I'm no longer alive to work on that part of myself,
right.
I started getting better.
And also, you can help other people. This story here will be very inspiring. A lot of people listening now with mental illness or, you know, depression and anxiety.
That's the hope,
and
definitely.
Loneliness. You know, one of our missions is to help eradicate loneliness by the year 2025.
Yes.
So through the mediums that we have, you know, a lot of people have money and other things, but they don't have love internally and externally. So that's the idea. So it's been wonderful to have you, MJ, on the show. Where can people hear more about you? Do you have any books or products? Or I know you even do a course, too. Tell us about what you do and how to reach you.
My website is happyok.club. And I chose the club on purpose, because I'm hoping that I will touch a lot of people who will be able to talk about their own issues. I'm hoping to give a voice to others. So I'm thinking about it as a club as opposed to a solo mission, right? So if you visit happyok.club, you can see where I'm having readings, and I do have a class. It's been online so far, where I teach people how to become more centered through writing.
Beautiful, beautiful. It's a wonder having you on the show, and we definitely want to have you back someday.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, because you're talking about giving people hope. A lot of people are at home, maybe they're shut-ins, introvert, shy, lonely, or depressed. But you write in ways that will inspire them. Really appreciate that from you. And that's our mission at Love University, is to help inspire people with that loving energy.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Until next time, Dr. Alex Avila. So, Love University students, if you have any questions, you can email us at loveuniversitylove@gmail.com, 310-226-8090. Visit us at loveuniversity.love. Like us on Facebook at Love University Podcast. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Love Letter U Podcast. Until next time, Love University students, put away your notepads, your books, your iPads, and this is Dr. Alex Avila.